Okay, so we started discussing the section of the Arayot, of the illicit relationships, which start in Vayikra Yudchet, and then pick up again in Vayikra Chaf. And we discussed why we have this repetition of the Arayot, what the function is of having the Kedusha section in the middle, why in the first unit you don't have the punishments, and the second one you do have punishments, the order, etc. But the question that we left off last week discussing is, like I said, less of a local Tanakh question as much as a meta question, which is, are the Arayot chukim or mishpatim? Meaning, are they meant to be understood? And like I said, this has become a a heated political question because, you know, some of the Arayot, nobody really cares whether they're, you know, a chok or they're a mishpat, whether they're meant to be understandable or not. Things like adultery, we assume, are, you know, mishpatim, that we understand why they're prohibited, why they're wrong. But where this has become heated is homosexuality, where, you know, you have people who will insist, even if, you know, they keep Torah, it is a chok and we don't understand it, and therefore, you know, anyone who's going through this struggle, so we just say, well, God said it, we don't understand it, so we can have empathy and leave it to God to judge. Right? Or you'll see people saying, no, it actually makes sense. There's a reason that Torah said it. I mean, that's obviously a very politically charged thing to say. So that type of discussion comes up a lot, and especially, you know, when you'll have people talk about the slippery slope, right? If when you heard this a lot in America, right? I assume I don't know if you did in Canada when it became legal in Canada, but when gay marriage became legal in America, you heard people saying, "What's next? What's the slippery slope going to lead to?" Well, a lot of that comes down to the question of, okay, well, are all the illicit relationships, are they meant to make sense? Or are they not meant to make sense, and therefore, right, they're just arbitrary, and if you remove one sanction, then you're going to remove another, and you're not going to draw the line between any of them. So that's the question I want to deal with, broadly speaking. Okay. So, as to this question, we actually have two very different indications in Chazal. So if you look at number one, the Gemara in Yoma in Samach Zayin Amud Bet presents one position. The Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, et mishpatai ta'asu, you should keep my mishpatim, again, following the notion that mishpat means a law that makes sense, as opposed to a chok, which is a law that does not make sense, or we don't understand what it means. Dvarim she'ilmalei nichtivu, dinhu she'yichtivu. These are laws that even if they hadn't been written, it would have made sense they should be written. The Elohein, and what are they? Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, Shvichut Tamim, idolatry, the illicit relationships, murder, the Gezel and theft, Uberchad Hashem, and blasphemy. V'chukotai Tishmiru, and then my chukim, meaning the laws that are hard to understand. What are those? Dvarim Sha'asatan Va'omot Aulam Mishivin Aleihem. Those are the things that the Satan and the other nations respond about, meaning they criticize us for. The Elohein, and what are they? Achilat Chazir, the prohibition against eating pig, Vilivishat Shatnez, the law against Shatnez, Vechalitzat Yivama, the laws of Chalitza, right, of the ending the leveret marriage, Vitarat Mitzorah, the laws of purity and impurity, Vesar Mishdaleach, and the goat which is sent out on Yom Kippur to be thrown off the mountain, Vishema Tomar Maasei Tohuim, and maybe you'll say about the Chukim, the laws we don't understand, that they are in vain, that they are meaningless. Talmud Lomar Ani Hashem. So the pasuk ends, I am God, Ani Hashem Chakaktiv, I am God, and I set them as law. Vein Zacharashut Laharher Bahem, so you can't challenge them. So the Gemara sets up, there's two categories, Chukim Umishpatim, things that we understand, things that we don't, and it puts the Arayot, the illicit relationships, firmly in the category of things that are understandable. So, therefore, we ask, right, is it just some arbitrary law, for example, that one can't commit adultery or one can't be involved in incest, whatever it might be? The answer is no, this makes sense. Why it makes sense, well, I have to come back to, but it makes sense. On the other hand, if you look at the Sifra in Kedoshim says as follows, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Omer. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, Minayin, okay, so we've actually seen this Sifra before, so we'll read it inside in a moment, but I'll summarize it outside first. The Sifra had said that when one refrains from being involved in an Avera, you shouldn't say, I'm not doing the Avera because I don't want to do the Avera. You should say, I'm not doing the Avera because maybe I do want to do the Avera, but God said no. The Rambam, we had noted in the in his Perish to Perkei Avos, or really in his Hakdama to Perkei Avos in the Shmona Prakim, said, well, you have sometimes in Chazal where they say that you're supposed to constantly be fighting against your Yetzer Hara, right? Don't say, I don't have any interest in eating pig. Say, I wish I could eat pig, but God said no. And therefore, every time you struggle, you're, you know, getting credit because you're showing that you're committed to God. But on the other hand, there are mitzvot where you really don't want that. You know, so for example, you don't want someone to say, well, I really wish I could murder, but I'm not because God is saying it, right? It would be very uncomfortable if we thought that everybody was really a closet, you know, desired to be a murderer, and it's just their commitment to God that's holding them back, but really they hate everybody they see. Or if we thought all of our friends wanted to kill us, they just didn't, because Hashem said so, that'd be very uncomfortable situations. The Rambam distinguished between chukim and mishpatim, right? Laws that make sense, we want you to keep them because they make sense. We want you to be kind because you're kind. We want you not to steal because you understand that it's wrong. We want you to be honest. We want you to have integrity. We don't care whether you're the type of person who desires pig, because the prohibition against pig doesn't make any sense. It's a choke. The point is to show obedience to God. So there you can say, I wish I could do it, but I won't. When it comes to ethical laws, laws that are meant to make sense, so you should keep them because they make sense, because they're the right thing to do. So that midrash, which the Rambam quotes, includes arayot in that category. So, for example, Rav Elazar ben Azariah Omer, minayin shelo yomar adam, e if she lo lo shatnes, e if she lo chol basar chazir, e if she lo vo al arva. How do you know that a person shouldn't say, I have no desire to wear shatnes, I have no desire to eat pig, I have no desire to be involved in the illicit relationships, aval if she. Rather, he should say, I wish I could. But what am I supposed to do? But God told me not to. Because the pasuk says, I've separated you from the nation to be mine. So you separate from the mitzvah in order to accept the yoke of God. And if we follow the Rambam's distinction, therefore arayot are now put in the category not of mishpatim, but of chukim, of things that we don't understand, and therefore the only reason we aren't engaged in these illicit relationships are because God said so. Now, one could distinguish between different ones of the arayot, right? You could say, so for example, right, adultery makes sense, and one of the others doesn't make sense, right? You could distinguish and say some of the arayot make sense, and some of them we don't understand. But at first glance, you really have this tension between the Gemara and Yoma and the Sifra. If you look at the Ramban in 4, the Ramban says, Tam Isur Harayot Bishair Habasar Einenu Mifurash. The Torah doesn't explain why there are all the incest laws. So some of the Mefarshim attempt. And now, right, so let's, the Ramban is going to give us a summary of some of the positions. Right, so if we take the position of the Gemara and Yoma, then in fact the arayot are meant to make sense. So then what is the logic behind them? Why are there prohibited relationships in general? Right, without getting to the details of them, why are the arayot at all? So Haravam Arba Mar Nebuchim. So first he quotes the Rambam. The Rambam says, Ki hu lema'et hamishgal, ulemoso to listapek menu bime'at. So the Rambam has a general position that he thinks that sexuality should be minimized, is inherently a negative thing, and therefore God put limitations on sexuality simply so we would understand that you shouldn't be involved in it too much. And he said, why do incest laws fit into this category? So he says, very simple. If sexuality is something we want to avoid, then what you have to do is you have to prohibit relationships between people who always live together, right? And siblings and parents and children, right, from a very young age are living together. And if you want to minimize the amount that people are engaged in sexuality, the first thing you do is you prohibit people to be with those who are in closest physical proximity to them, because that would allow for, right, unrestrained sexuality. So that's how the Rambam understands the arayot. The Rambam goes on to use this to explain everything. Ukvar Katav Rabbi Avraham Gamken, the Ibn Ezra says a similar reason. ki ba'avur hayot yetzer lev ha'adam ke behemot. Lo yitachen lasar kol anekevot. Rabbi Ibn Ezra similarly follows a negative view of sexuality and says, people aren't animals. People have an animalistic side to them, and they are, right? They have a base side to them, and therefore, you can't forbid sexuality. Hine asar kol nimsot imo b'v'chol shah. So instead, what we prohibited were the people who are closest to you, in closest proximity. So both the Rambam and Ibn Ezra say the reason there are ayot at all are because the Torah opposes excessive sexuality, and therefore the first thing it did was prohibit people from being with those who are physically close to them, their immediate relatives. The Ramban responds, and he says, "V'zeh tam chalush me'od." This is very weak. Shechayev akadov karet al eila b'avuri matani molefamim. I don't get it. According to you, there's no reason, according to the Rambam and even Ezra, there's no reason why one shouldn't be intimate with his mother more than anybody else. It's just that the Torah didn't want you to be involved in sexuality too much. He said, for that you get kares, right? It sounds like the Torah objectively opposes incest and opposes incest. You can't tell me that the Torah gave you kares, right? According to the Rambam and Ezra, the prohibitions against all the illicit relationship, all of incest, is just a stand-in for the Torah's general principle that you should minimize how much you're involved in sexuality. But let's say one did violate, for that you're going to get karet, right? It sounds like these particular relationships are problematic, not just like they stand in for a broader category. Besides, if that was the prohibition, then the Torah should have prohibited polygamy, but it didn't. Right, you could marry 1,000 wives, according to the strict letter of Torah law. So if the purpose of the arayot was to minimize sexuality, the Torah didn't do a very good job with this. Right? If it's from the perspective of just minimizing physical relationships, so fine. Say that you have to have monogamy and permit incest. And then say, okay, a person can have a spouse. If he wants to marry his daughter, fine, right? As long as he only marries one, right? You could come up with that, right? That the laws just don't fit. He said, you could make an argument that there's no better relationship than a person just marrying his son and his daughter to each other, right? They're already living in the same house, right? They're already comfortable with each other, so great. Therefore, the Ramban says, I don't really know why it's prohibited. I have no tradition for it. But there seems to be some sort of secret. But then he says after the ellipsis, so what's his conclusion? The arayot are chukim. We don't understand them. Dvarim shem gzirat melech. They're just decrees of the king. Vagzeira hu adavar haoleh al dat hamelech shuah chacham b'anagat malchuto. The decrees are that which the king thought are wise to do. Hu ayudat zorech vatoel b'mitzvah hishi tzaveba. He knows why it's meaningful. V'lo yakido to la'amzu adiloch chmeyatzav, but he didn't tell us except to the most wise. So Ramban therefore rejects the Rambam. And Ibn Ezra says, no, the reason of the arayot is unknown. It is a chok. So we have these two positions here, the Rambam, the Ibn Ezra following the Sifra, seemingly, that the Arayot are meant to make sense, and the Ramban following the Gemara in, the other way around, the Sifra following and the Ramban following Sifra, that the Arayot don't make sense, they're just Hukim, we keep them because God said so, and the Rambam, the Ibn Ezra, saying no, they are Mishpatim, and following the Gemara in Yoma. The Ramban criticizes the specific reason of the Rambam and Ibn Ezra, namely that they're just meant to minimize sexuality, because it sounds like there's something more fundamental to them, but he doesn't explain what. The problem, and we'll see in a moment, this is what Rassamit picks up on, and I think he's right, is that neither of these poles seem to make sense. On the one hand, it's very hard to say, like the Ramban or the Sifra, that the Arayot are pure chukim, are things that we don't understand at all. Because, as we know, all cultures have had some sort of prohibition against incest. Like, at the margins, they've argued about this particular relationship or that relationship, but almost any culture you look at, even cultures that had no interaction with each other, prohibited relationships between parents and children, between siblings, right? You had in certain cultures, especially monarchy, so people would marry their sisters, but it wasn't like common, and most cultures had some notion of prohibited relationships, something. On the other hand, it's hard to pin it down as a pure mishpat, because very few cultures have the exact same incest laws, right? If you're leaving it up to common sense, you would expect people to come up with the same laws, but they don't, right? Whether it be what exactly is defined as incest, right? Where do you cut it off? Do you cut it off at siblings? Do you cut it off at first cousins? At second cousins? Right? What about uncles? Right? And aunts? Right? What about former sons-in-law and daughters-in-law? Right? All those can be, subject to dispute. So on the one hand, it's not a pure chok, right? Because every we have an intuitive sense it makes sense. On the other hand, it's not a pure mishpat because we can't articulate why it makes sense. So Rav Savitz says is maybe we have to stop thinking about chukim and mishpatim as two poles. Right? As chukim is laws we don't understand, or even more extreme, laws that have no reason. But let's go with the mainstream view in Rishonim. Chukim are things that make sense to God, but we don't understand. And mishpatim, which are things that we totally understand. So maybe there are things in the middle. So that's the argument he tries to make. So that's what they have in 5. He says, on the one hand, obviously, the prohibitions of arayot cannot be defined as statutes that the nations of the world answer for them, meaning that they make fun of. Anthropological study reveals that in every human society, there is a prohibition of forbidden sexual relations, incest. There is no society in which sexual relations are permitted between a man and his mother, or his sister, or his daughter. Likewise, there is no society in which the prohibition is limited only to first-degree relations. Rather, it is extended to secondary relations in different ways in each society. This is, on the one hand, every culture has some notion of incest, including expansive incest laws. On the other hand, when we attempt to indicate the reason for the prohibition of arayot, which are so deeply rooted in human society, and so close to every individual member thereof, we sense that the explanations given are generally unsatisfying. We may assume that there is no single reason for this taboo, but rather that it is bound up with various biosocial processes and remains an enigma both in mythology and in science. Right? So he's quoting from the Hebrew Encyclopedia by Harvey Goldberg. Right. So on the one hand, it's hard to call it a chok, because if the standard of chok, as the Gemara in Yoma says, is things that the world makes fun of us for, they don't make fun of us for having incest laws, everyone has incest laws. On the other hand, if the definition of mishpat is something that I can easily explain why this is prohibited or why this is a good thing, the arayot are very hard, right? We have a general sense, but we can't really pin it down. So then Rav Samet suggests, so he says, anyone who senses that he is encountering an enigma whose solution drifts somewhere in the midst of the historical, philosophical, spiritual sphere, will certainly accept the definition of the prohibition of the arayot as a statute, as a decree made by the king of the universe, and he knows the need for and the purpose of the mitzvah that he is commanding. It seems that the distinction between those mitzvot of the Torah that are mishpatim and those that are chukim is not as clear as we may have believed. There are mitzvot, such as arayot, which lie somewhere between the two spheres. They have aspects that attach them to the category of chukim, while other aspects would seem to categorize them as mishpatim. There are mitzvot which one commentator or philosopher regard as chukim, while another would define them as mishpatim. Again, we've seen this in the case of arayot. The Rambam's view concerning the mitzvah, as explained in Mor Nevuchim, is that the mitzvot all have a reason, and they were commanded for their benefits. Those mitzvot whose benefits are clear to the masses are called mishpatim, and those whose benefit is not clear to the masses are called chukim. So then he says, okay, well, what is a chok and a mishpat? So again, Rashi thinks that a chok is something which makes no sense, a mishpat is something which makes sense. But the Rambam says no. A chok is something which makes sense to people, it doesn't make sense to the masses, and mishpat is something which makes sense to the masses. Meaning, it's not a hard and fast rule, things which make sense and things which don't. It's things that most people understand and most people don't. So he says, to this view, the distinction between chukim and mishpatim exists only for the benefit of the recipients of the Torah. The Torah distinguishes between these two categories only for educational reasons. Because of the difficulty of observing the mitzvot, and because of the need to strengthen us in our observance of those that we perceive as chukim. Now, if this is the case, right, that chukim and mishpatim are not fundamental categories, they are, do most people get them or most people not understand them, so then Rav Salman notes that it's really an educational tool, right? It's the existence of chok is meant to tell us that even if there's a law you don't understand, that's okay, and it can be binding. Because there are laws that you don't have to understand. It's not that there is no reason. It's not that you can't come up with a reason. It's that educationally, we should teach ourselves that it's okay if there are mitzvot we don't understand. So the Rishon then concludes, in light of all that we have said, the line dividing chukim and mishpatim is dynamic in the historical sense as well. Right, once you say that chukim and mishpatim is really an educational category, right, things that we understand and things that we don't, so then it can change. A general consensus in one generation that a certain mitzvah is a chok may change in a different generation, where the reason for the mitzvah is revealed, such that it is from then on considered as falling within the category of mishpatim. This may work in the opposite direction as well. A change of perceptions and views in the course of the generations can bring about a situation in which mitzvot whose reasons were regarded as clear and obvious in earlier generations may face the prosecution of the nations of the world in another generation with the accusation that the Torah of Israel does not suit the spirit and the progress of the times. Right? So he says, if that's the case, so maybe the Ariyot are in between. There's something which can change. Some generations, some periods of the world, everyone understood them, and therefore it was a mishpat. Because even if you couldn't articulate it, right, we can't articulate everything that makes sense to us, but things make sense, we don't bother explaining them, right? If someone really, really wanted to be a radical skeptic, so they would ask, you know, why is it a mitzvah to give tzedakah? Well, because we should help people who are unfortunate. Well, why should we help people who are unfortunate? Because it's the right thing to do, because it's nice. Why should you be nice, right? At some point, we're going to get to a point where we can't answer it. But we don't think of it as a chok, even though we can't really explain why we are nice, because we all understand, right? We have an intuitive sense that being nice is good, that it's not something that needs to be explained. So, Rassam had suggested maybe the Arayot are something in between. Yes, there were generations where all the Arayot made sense. And even though you couldn't pin down why they made sense, you had an intuitive sense they made sense, and therefore, no one would challenge it. And then there are generations where the Arayot don't make sense. Now, he doesn't say this explicitly, but I assume that this is what he's thinking, right? Is that this gives, I think, important language to deal with the homosexuality issue, right? Because what you'll have, basically, is you'll have people saying, well, for all of history, people thought it made sense. It wasn't just that it was a law that was accepted. It was the world thought homosexuality should be prohibited. Not just that it was, but that it was morally wrong. So how can you now say it's morally right? Well, if you think that homosexuality is a pure mishpat, then that's a good question, right? But if you say, well, it's not really a mishpat, it's not really a chok, it's somewhere in between, and therefore it could be that there are generations where it made sense to everybody, and therefore you don't really have to explain it. Nowadays, you're right, it doesn't make sense to the world, but it's still true. So we can call it, historically, at this point, a chok. And even if in the history it made sense to people, including Jews, and now it doesn't, that's okay. Because maybe the categories of chok and mishpat are fluid, right? That the arayot are somewhere in between. They sort of make sense, but they're not, you can't pin it down. And therefore there may be generations where you have no problem saying it makes sense, and other ones where you say, maybe I don't get it, and therefore you say it's a chok. Okay. But is it just arbitrary, right? Is it just like, you know, well, okay. There are chukim, there are mishpatim, right? Sometimes things are in between. They used to be considered mishpatim, but now we don't understand them. They're chukim, right? Or not. So, not relating to the Tanakh part of it, and Ray Clapper has, and he's published this in several different articles at different points, has come up with what he's called the process of chokification, right? Where he's tried to ask the question, what does it mean for us to choose to call something a chok? Right, because once, if you think that the distinction between chok and mishpat is objective, then there are things which make sense and things that we don't understand, and those are objective and we can't change them. But if you take a Rav Samet-like approach, that no, there are in fact things in between, so why would you choose, let's say, homosexuality? Right? Why would you choose to call it a chok? And why would you choose to say no? I don't want to just say, right, if you have two people, both who are committed to the Torah, and therefore committed to saying that homosexuality is usur, is forbidden, right? Why would one choose to treat it as a chok and say, I know God said it's wrong, but I don't understand why? And why would someone else say, no, I do understand, because, you know, sexuality has to be tied to procreation or whatever reason you want to give, right? Is there a reason why one would choose to treat something as a chok or rather than a mishpat? So here, right, Clapper suggests something that I think is very important, right? So he says, he starts off, he says, a core concept of popular Orthodox thought is the distinction between chukim and mishpatim as presented by Rashi. And this view, mitzvot are classified by whether they do or do not have a humanly intelligible purpose. So, can halachot change categories? The question then is whether halachot can legitimately move from one category to another over time. Thus, laws regarding Canaanite slaves may once have seemed intuitive, but is now popular to regard them as concessions to pre-Torah feudal morality. This is quasi-rational, but a dangerous one. It is a quasi-rationale, rather, but a dangerous one. Cannot all mitzvot be seen as concessions to past moral systems if they seem out of place to contemporaries? Nonetheless, I hope and pray that no one today would take the laws of Canaanite slavery as models for the treatment of minorities in Israel. Practically, historicization has the same effect as declaring these laws to be chukim, right? Claiming something, saying that slavery was an improvement on, right? The laws of slavery were an improvement of slavery that existed thousands of years ago, is in effect saying it's a chok nowadays, right? The Torah really doesn't like slavery. It just wanted to improve slavery as long as it existed. But now we don't need those laws, right? But it's the same effect as making it into a chok. It's nowadays, these are irrelevant to our lives. But now he says, what's at stake? So he says, categorizing a mitzvah detail, mitzvah, or complex of mitzvot, as chok rather than mishpat, has the effect of quarantining it from normal halachic conversation. And indeed, it has the effect of stigmatizing anyone seeking to reintroduce it as lacking proper religious intuition. Conversely, categorizing a halacha as mishpat rather than chok effectively accuses those who quarantine it of closing themselves off to the full implications of God's word. So what does that mean? Right, so he says as follows, and I think this is very important. Let's take a mishpat, a classic mishpat. Right? Let's stick with tzedakah. Right? Tzedakah, what is the mitzvah of tzedakah? Mitzvah is to help out the needy. Okay. So now, let's say you have a poor person, and, you know, he's not really poor, right? The classic categories of poor in the time of the Torah were someone who didn't have enough food for a day or for, you know, 2 weeks. Well, let's say in Torah categories he's not poor, right? He has a house, he has enough food he has enough food stocked up in his closets for the next 6 months, right? He has enough money in the bank to pay for rent and pay for electricity. And then that person comes to the school and says, look, I have enough money for food, and I have enough money for basic needs and rent, but I don't have enough money for tuition, right? So should the community provide tuition assistance for that person? Right? This is a very common question. Well, we all intuitively say yes, because the Torah believes that people who are better off should help those who are not as well off. And tuition is really expensive, and we understand that someone could not be technically poor. He has food and clothes and electricity and rent, but can't pay $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 post-tax dollars a year for tuition. And therefore, if somebody can, right, somebody is a multimillionaire and can donate $1 million to a tuition assistance fund or can help fund the school so they can lower tuition for the general public, we say that's valuable, because we say tzedakah, in its classic sense, means that we help those who are less well off than we are. And even if none of us are really poor and struggling for food, tuition assistance is also a form of tzedakah. The reason we can do that is because we think, I think correctly, that tzedakah is a mishpat. That it's a law that makes sense. And therefore, we can expand on the original category, and we can look at it and say, okay, well, what is the logic behind tzedakah, right? It's about people who are better off helping those who aren't as well off. Well, that applies in the extreme where someone doesn't have food, but also extreme, it also means that people who are better off in society, in our community, should help fund the institutions that the rest of us don't have enough money to fund because they're so exorbitant. But what would happen if someone said, no, tzedakah is a chok. It's not a mishpat. Why do you think it makes sense? I give my tzedakah to poor people who don't have food because God said so. But it doesn't represent a value, it's just a law that God said. And therefore, it only applies where it applies. It applies when someone doesn't have food, but it doesn't apply when someone can't pay tuition, right? Pay tuition, right? If someone thought tzedakah was a chok, that would be a conclusion that they could come to. Which, no problem. Which shows you that there's a cost to calling something a chok. If you call something a mishpat, what you are really saying is that this is not just a law, it's a value that teaches us how to live our lives, even when the technical law doesn't apply. But the second you call something a chok, what you're saying is this is just a law, but it doesn't teach us anything about our life. It teaches us that you should give money, right? If tzedakah is a chok, then it teaches us we should give money to someone who can't put food on the table, but not give money to someone who can't pay for tuition, because it applies when it applies, it doesn't apply when it doesn't apply. Don't try arguing with me, it makes sense. Right? The second you call something a chok, it loses applicability. It loses broad applicability. So, Clapper therefore notes, even if it's correct that we can say, well, a law used to be a mishpat, but now we treat it as a chok because we don't understand it, we should at least realize that there's a cost to that decision. Because now, right, if in the past, let's say, right, people could say, well, we understand why homosexuality is prohibited because the Torah values procreation, right, values having children. If you say, okay, but nowadays the world values, autonomy and love more than procreation, and therefore, you know, and as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else, why should we prohibit it? And therefore, I don't understand why God said homosexuality is also, but it is, so it's a chok. So fine, you're still committed to God's word. But now when someone says, well, how do you know that the Torah really thinks that sexuality should be tied to procreation, you just lost the data point. Because you just defined homosexuality as a chok, meaning something that is a law but makes no sense, and therefore it can't shed light on anything else. So the choice to call it a chok is a choice to say this becomes just a law, but not a data point when trying to create a vision of what Torah wants for life in general. So it may be a legitimate decision, but it's not a decision that doesn't come at a cost. Right, so he says it should also be clear that mishpat advocates are right to be worried about slippery slope, as each concession on their parts makes the halacha less reflective of their rationales and therefore more susceptible to chokification. So he says, I will say by way of self-disclosure that I do believe that the option of declaring something a chok is legitimate. At the same time, I fully agree that this technique is highly susceptible to abuse through deception, including self-deception, and should be used only with great caution. Finally, there may be some room for mishpat advocates to admit that we often shouldn't have enough confidence in our rationales to impose their implications on others, and for chok advocates to admit that quarantining Dvar Hashem is a bold move that should be undertaken only as a last resort. Right. So what he pushes is to, and I think this is important, is to at least recognize the cost on both sides. Right. The cost of calling something a chok is it ceases to be something that influences the rest of our perspective of Torah. The cost of calling something a mishpat, on the other hand, is that, you know, let's take an easy example, right? His example, which I cut out in the middle, is if you take the killing of Amalek as a pure mishpat, right, then you might end up encouraging genocide for anybody else you think is Amaleki-like. And you don't really want people to be able to do that. So it's very comfortable for us to say, yeah, killing Amalek as a mishpat is a chok, and therefore, it only applies to actual Amalekim, and don't start applying it to whatever nation you happen to hate and want an excuse to, right, be violent against, right? So there's a benefit sometimes to quote-unquote quarantining laws, but on the other hand, there's a cost, because you obviously don't want to allow people to chokify, you know, tzedakah, or chokify Shabbos, or chokify, I don't know, right, take your pick. But despite that cost, I think it's worth noting, in light of what Rav Samet said, that maybe that is a legitimate method, to recognize there are certain laws that are somewhere in between, and therefore, on the one hand, to allow people who want to be committed to Torah but don't understand a given law to say, I'm willing to call it a chok, this way I'm committed to God but I don't have to think about the implications of this law, and allow the possibility that other people may want to treat it as a mishpat and say, no, it does teach us something about life. Those are legitimate options, especially if chok and mishpat are fluid categories, right, which aren't set. And like I said, right, Ray Klapper wrote one article where he uses this argument in the context of homosexuality. He uses it in another article. This one is actually about women's roles in Judaism, right? Those are both highly, right, complicated and controversial categories where, right, you see this debate coming up. In homosexuality, we've discussed, but the same is true of women's roles where, you know, for example, do you take the Sifra's limitation that women can't be kings, right, as a chok, and therefore all it means is that a woman can't be the monarch, but it doesn't mean they can't be leaders, it doesn't mean they can't be rabbis, it doesn't mean they can't be anything else, or you take it as a mishpat, right, that it represents a certain division of roles that are essentialist, right, that spill over into other leadership roles, right? At some level, that question of, I mean, obviously there are halachic factors as well, but that question of whether you expand on the clear halachic data and say this isn't just a law, but it represents a whole worldview, is a question of do you treat as a chok or as a mishpat? And at some level, what he was arguing in this piece is that that's the machloket you see around whether women can be rabbis, is do you treat the limitations that clearly exist as chukim, and therefore they exist where they do and they don't in other categories, or are they mishpatim, which represent a certain worldview? Okay. Now, just to close this issue, right, now we've moved beyond that. Okay, so if the arayot are therefore in a middle category where they could be chukim, could be mishpatim, the last question relates to say, okay, well, let's assume that they somewhat make sense and recognize that we don't need to reach the bar of saying this must be true, right? They're an in-between category where they have an intuitive logic, but they're not, right? We can't pin it down to the end. Okay, but at least can we get some sort of intuitive logic, right? Do they make sense at all? So the Rambam and the Ibn Ezra say they're just about limiting sexuality in general. But do we have something that actually makes the specific arayot make sense? Not like the notion that there should be illicit relationships, but the specific arayot makes sense. So here, I put two suggestions. They're both quoted by Rav Samet. One is his own, and one he quotes from Hillel Zeitlin. So Hillel Zeitlin, in his 11th letter to the Jewish youth, writes as follows. He says, the Torah states quite clearly, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father and the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. And so on concerning all the rest of the arayot as they are listed. And the second half of the pasuk explains the reason for what is written in the first half. If the woman is your mother or your sister, etc., you're forbidden to conduct sexual relations with her, etc. If you conduct sexual relations with your sister or with one of your other female relatives listed by the Torah, you offend the sisterliness of your sister. You damage the honor of the relationship with that female relative. If you approach a woman out of desire and sexual attraction, it's not possible to continue to relate to her with the same proper honor due to her, to relate to any woman with respect and profound appreciation, at the same time to conduct sexual relations with her is truly a contradiction, although people are not prepared to admit this. So Hillel Zeitlin takes a particular view of the world, which is that sexuality is always a game of objectification, really, right? He follows a whole, you know, like Freudian worldview, right? That sexuality is always an act of objectification. So therefore, he says, well, therefore what you need is to limit, if you were to allow sexuality, right, you allow incest, then what would you be doing? You would, right, our most wholesome relationships in life are those with our immediate relatives, right? They're the ones that we tend to think of as, you know, relationships that are pure, they're altruistic, right, with parents and children and siblings. We love our parents and our children and our siblings because they're our parents or our children. It doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter, right? We always love them even when they make mistakes, no matter what, right? Because we recognize there's a value in life to having certain relationships that are impervious, right? Friendship is dependent on common values. We all understand that there's a certain value of having some relationships in life that are not contingent on anything. Well, Hillel Zeitlin says, well, wait a second. All sexual relationships are dependent on something. There's an act of objectification. There's an act of reducing our relationship to being about something in particular. If you allow that to happen amongst immediate relatives, we would be left with no relationships which are pure. And therefore, Zeitlin says, maybe that's why every culture has incest laws, because they want there to be certain relationships which are pure, right? Parents and children, siblings, should not view their parents, children, siblings, as potential partners. They're just your sister, your brother, your mother, your daughter, your father, your son. They're people that you love because you love. They're your mother. They're not potential partners. They're not potential anything. They are just family, Right? That's what Zeitlin is saying, right? There's the reason that every culture, to whatever extent, has incest laws is because there must be some relationships which are pure. Now, he says this because he thinks all sexuality is necessarily, right, negative and an act of objectification. Rassamet takes it a little bit less extreme, and he says, look, I don't need that, right? I mean, Zeitlin just thought that all of sexuality was like that, and that's why he, you know, tried to limit it. But he said, we have another possibility. He said, in 8, he says, the human family is perhaps the most important cultural achievement of mankind in the sphere of its social life and in the sphere of the cultural regulation of sexual activity. Life in the family framework is what the Torah prescribes for man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become a single flesh. The family framework is surrounded with an entire system of mitzvot, which regulate it, protect its proper maintenance. The prohibitions of arayot are the negative aspect of the maintenance of the family. The existence of the family, from both the biological and psychological perspective, demands the restraint of the sexual relations within it and their limitation to a man and woman who are married to one another, forming the foundation of a family. Without the laws of arayot, the human family would have no existence. This is expressed by one of the major social anthropologists of the 20th century, B. Malinowski. In every human culture, we find, first of all, some well-defined taboo system strictly separating the two sexes of whole groups and not allowing contact between them. The most important prohibition prevents any possibility of marriage between close relatives of the same family. The second most important law of the taboo of forbidden sexual relationships concerns adultery. While the aim of the first prohibition is to protect the family, the second protects marriage. The Rambam was therefore correct in explaining the reason for the prohibition of arayot as being because each of them is always present in his home. And Hillel Zeitlin was correct in the sensitivity to what is explicit in the Torah as the reason of each individual sexual union, namely, she is your mother, she's your sister, etc. Except that according to what we have explained above, the reasons are different from those proposed by each of them. Right? So what Rav Samet suggests is, right, Zeitlin just thinks that sexuality is always an act of objectification. That's a problem. Rav Samet says, no, maybe the reason every culture has incest laws, right, has two laws, incest and adultery, right, is because there are two things you want to maintain in life. One is the sanctity of your nuclear family, namely, that you understand that you have pure relationships, right, that can't then turn into a different type of relationship. Your siblings will always be your siblings, right, not also potential marriage partners. They're just your siblings and your parents and your children, etc. And adultery, because you want to allow people to create new family units. In order to do that, you need to respect the institution of marriage. So Rav Samet suggests that maybe, even though I can't pin down the arayot, the purpose of the arayot is to create healthy families, right? Adultery ensures the sanctity of marriages, and incest ensures that within a nuclear relationship, no one else will become potential partners. They'll remain as your pure family, you know, familiar relationship, those relationships you can fall back on that aren't dependent on anything and don't, right, are meant to just be pure, loving relationships. So again, even though Rav Samet thinks that the arayot are not really chukim mishpatim, he says the reason that every society has them, that they have a certain level of intuition, is because they do manage to create a healthy family, right? Even though you can argue at the margins, right? Should you include first cousins or not, right? That's a good question, right? Cultures can argue about that. But the fact that there's certain members of your family should be your family and family alone and not spouses, right, makes sense because it manages to create a healthy family. I just put at the end that there are a few of the arayot that don't fit into this category, and each of them have different reasons. So, for example, nida, right, obviously doesn't fit in this category, and that's why it doesn't get the criticism of toiva, for example, in the Torah, because nida is a totally different category. It's not a normal one of the arayot because it doesn't talk about, right, it talks about a time period rather than a person, right? So it's totally different. Two sisters, right? You're only prohibited to marry two sisters at the same time, or when they're both living, right? But not if one sister dies, you can marry the second sister. In fact, historically, that happened a lot because if someone died with young children, right? If it worked, the best person to raise their children is the children's aunt. So Rav Samet notes that prohibition specifically of two sisters, the Torah gives you a different reason, which is litzror, right? Don't marry two sisters, litzror. What is litzror? To make the two sisters, in English, co-wives, but literally, litzror is to oppress each other or to compete against each other, right? The prohibition of two sisters is not because it's fundamentally wrong. It's because it creates an unhealthy relationship, right, between them. And Rav Samet notes, and I'll just leave it with this, is that the problem that everyone always asks is, okay, well, if two sisters is one of the arayot, how did Yaakov do it, right? So he says, well, if all the arayot that we've talked about until now are fundamental, but the one of two sisters isn't a fundamental moral problem, is that it creates tension within the family, then maybe either it's not objectively wrong, it's just normally not a good idea. So the Torah forbade it, but okay, Yaakov did it. Or, he says more plausibly, maybe the reason the Torah forbade it, right, was because of the Yaakov story, right? Is that, right, it's one of those arayot that is because is a function of the fact that it creates tension, and maybe the reason that we hear about this problems with Rachel and Leah is to teach us why the Torah came and prohibited this law, even though it doesn't fit the normal framework of arayot, right? Marrying two sisters is not destroying the institution of marriage, it's not destroying the family unit, right? But it does create Shalom Bayis problems, right? How do you know? Because of the Yaakov story. So we just maybe some of the other arayot, we have to look for clues, such as in the Gezi Two Sisters around the Torah, why they become arayot, even though they don't fit the general category. So that I'll leave to you as something to think about. Okay.